Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Ma! Bennett was standing at the back door, dripping wet. Can we take the van to school for the car wash? What? His mom headed quickly for the door. Why do you need the van? I was planning to go to the grocery store in a few minutes and then pick up the plants from the nursery. Oh, well, some more members of the team are going to come help for about an hour, and I said I could pick them up. Bennett, his mom sighed. I just wish you'd let me know in advance when you need the van. Then we could work out our plans together. Ah, Mom, Bennett jangled his keys and looked at the floor. Sometimes I just don't know. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about the development of the teenage brain? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today studies child and adolescent brains, focusing on the biological basis of behavioral disorders. Dr. Jay Geed is a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist and chief of brain imaging in the child psychiatry branch at the National Institute of Mental Health at the National Institutes of Health. His work with magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, studies has shed new light on brain development in both healthy and neuropsychiatrically impaired youngsters. Dr. Geed is the father of four teenagers in training, as he calls them, a 10-year-old daughter, and three boys, 8, 5, and 3. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Geed.
Thank you very much.
We're glad with all those kids that you have the energy to come.
Dr. Geed, there was an article published by the National Institute of Mental Health that was called Teenage Brain, a Work in Progress. All parents of teens out there are silently saying, Amen. Why is it still in progress? And when can frazzled parents hope for it to be finished?
Well, any parent of a teenager can tell you that the brain of a 15-year-old is quite different than the brain of an 8-year-old. But to actually pin down those differences in a scientific way has been elusive. Mm-hmm. And that's because nature's gone through a great deal of trouble to protect the brain. It's wrapped in a tough, leathery membrane, surrounded by a protective mode of fluid, and then completely encased in bone. And that's done a good job of shielding the brain from falls or attacks from predators, but it's also done a good job of shielding the brain from a scientist. And it was only in recent years, with the development of MRI or magnetic resonance imaging, that we've been able, for the first time, to look inside the living, growing teen brain. And what we found surprised us.
How did it surprise you? All the parents out there are going, yeah.
From earlier work, we saw that the size of the brain is already 90% of adult size by age 6, or in first grade.
So you'd think they would know that they're supposed to put their stuff in their drawers when they're done.
Right. We were quite surprised that it was so far along at such a young age. And only when we looked closer by actually following individual children through their development, by having them come back for scans at each 2 years, did we see that even though the total size of the brain is pretty set young, there was a lot of dynamic activity going on. It's sort of like the frame and structure of the house are built early, but then all of the furnishing and electrical work and remodeling inside takes place after that.
So you can see that much detail in the MRI?
Yeah, we were really struck by how dynamic these changes were. Looking at perhaps a 10% difference from age 5 to 20, we were just completely taken aback when we saw that even though the changes occur almost at a glacial speed on average, when we actually look at individual children, their brain is just bursting with activity, and it doesn't grow in a steady way. It's in fits and starts, and we're very interested in when those fits and starts are happening and whether that might have implications for parenting or for teachers or even society.
So we don't know yet about whether the behavior is a reflection of the fits and starts. That's still up for grabs?
The details are the focus of all of the research these days. We know that these changes are influenced by the genes and by the environment, perhaps by nutrition or bacteria or virus or video games. And all these details are what the researchers are trying to sort out.
Which makes it very hard down in the trenches, right?
Yeah, so the basic trade-off is the younger brains have many, many connections between the brain cells. And an analogy that comes to mind is if you're driving down a rural country road, it's a gravel road, you can't go very fast, but you're able to turn off every quarter of a mile or so. lots of choices. As you grow older and you use certain paths again and again, those paths become more like superhighways. You can zoom down those common paths 100 times faster than before, but you can't always turn off every quarter of a mile. You have to wait for the exit or might have to go down farther. And so the trade-off is that we need to specialize in certain pathways, but at the expense of not being able to do all things equally well anymore.
Which puts a lot of pressure on parents who feel they're supposed to be helping this process along.
Yes, it does. The peaks of the number of connections and where the brain cells are maximally connected is about 11 in girls and 12 in boys. And after that time, then the use it or lose it principle seems to kick in, and those cells and connections that we use survive and flourish. Those cells and connections that we don't use can wither and die. So it becomes a time when the stakes are high in terms of optimizing the brain for the adult years.
That's when we lean on our kids to do their homework and practice their instrument or whatever?
Yeah, whether leaning on them is the most effective way or not is one of the questions that we're looking at in terms of a lot of times the teens themselves with information can become more self-motivated to use their time well during these years. And what sort of things should they be using their time for? It's easy to err on the side of too much structure, too much homework, too many music lessons when a lot of the brain may be more suited for social interactions and playing and things that we don't perhaps regard as highly, but actually may be very important for long-term health and happiness.
What you're saying, though, sounds like the pressure almost would be normal to be before these peak times. I mean, we always think things peak in adolescence, but you're saying that they're finding that these connections are peaking much earlier.
Right. There's a lot of emphasis on the first 3 years of life and a lot of well-meaning telethons and funding for research focusing on the first 3 years of life, which was a great idea and well-meaning and all good intentions. But the longer that we've been studying brain development, we see that there is no downtime in terms of the first 3 years are important, and so are the next three, and so are the next three, and all the way on through development. And the optimal times for when the brain can receive our instructions best may be quite specific. It may be different for languages and for mathematics or for morality or social skills. And the challenge is to see if we can go backwards from seeing how the brain is growing in fits and starts and what that might mean for us as parents.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on the adolescent brain.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Jay Geed about the adolescent brain, a work in progress. So, in terms of parents and educators figuring out about what subjects are optimally presented, what do we know at this point? I think there's always been a little bit of an issue about when you start languages and all that, and music, some other things like that.
Yeah, for certain tasks, these so-called critical or sensitive periods are fairly well understood. A lot of people may remember a picture of Gosling following a man named Conrad Lorenz because he was the first moving thing they saw after birth, and they, in a sense, think that he's their mother. Or for things like the visual system, if you have cataracts, a clouding of the lens of the eye, and it's not corrected by 18 months of life, even if you correct the lenses, the brain can't handle the visual input. And so there are pretty well understood examples for those basic sort of things, but much controversy over whether that would also hold for learning things like right from wrong, and can we rehabilitate people who have never been habilitated in the first place, and language skills, if you take a 2-year-old American child and move them to China and a 20-year-old, bright, dedicated college student who's studying Chinese for 4 years in college. At age six, the young child will be able to speak better than the college student. And that, from a brain science perspective, is nothing short of remarkable, of how the brain seems to be very receptive to learning languages at certain ages.
Dr. Geed, what else is there that we should know about structural changes that happen in the brain?
Well, how does the brain, the most complicated 3-pound mass of matter in the known universe, become the brain? It does so through two simple but powerful processes. And the first one is overproduction. There are way more brain cells and connections formed than can possibly survive. There's only so many nutrients, only so many growth factors, and there's only so much room in the skull. And the second powerful process is war, or competitive elimination. The connections fight it out for survival, sometimes called neural Darwinism, survival of the fittest connections. But nature's way of making sure that the ones that do survive are healthy and robust and strong. And this process of overproduction and selective elimination was known to occur in the womb, maybe the first 18 months of life. But it was only when we followed individual children throughout childhood and adolescence that we saw this second wave of overproduction, which we can note with a thickening of the gray matter, the outermost part of the brain. And this thickness increases throughout childhood, peaking at age 11 in girls and 12 in boys, and then thins down throughout adolescence. And we often are asked, when does development stop? When do these teen years end? And the answer seems to be much later than previously thought, that it's not late teens or even at age 20. If we had to pick a number, it would probably be around age 25 when the wiring is most like the adult years.
That's really a surprise.
That's interesting. I wonder what that means for, like, lending the car and other stuff.
Well, that's actually a very good example, because I always thought that 25 seemed very late, because we can vote and get married and do all these adult decisions at a much younger age. And the thing that struck home with me was, while at the airport of renting a car, that you have to be 25 to rent a car. Mm-hmm. And they either have very good neuroscientists in the car rental industry, or they have some good insurance information that 24-year-olds may cost them more than 25-year-olds. But it's interesting for us sometimes how we can learn a lot about human behavior, not so much from neuroscience, but from advertising, marketing, and buying trends.
Does this brain development have to do with risk-taking in, say, adolescent boys, for example?
Yes, I think it's very connected in terms of the risk-taking and how the brain decides what sort of decisions it can make along the way. Because the overwhelming impact from the brain imaging studies is how incredibly plastic the brain is. Humans can live on the North Pole, or we can live on the equator. We can adapt to so many different environments. And the only way that could be possible was to build in this flexibility or change. The same brain that we used for gathering berries and surviving in the wild, we're now using to program computers or VCRs. And this enormous plasticity peaks right before the teen years. And in order to sort out what skills and abilities are needed, the risk-taking is an important part of that. When we take risks and something happens in the environment, that can then teach us whether that was a good or bad risk to take. And in reductionist terms, in terms of brain chemistry, dopamine is the currency for telling us whether we've made a good or bad decision. It kind of goes back to the old Freudian pleasure principles. If we make decisions that lead to pleasure, we're more likely to make those decisions again. If we make decisions that cause us pain, we're not as likely to make those decisions again. And it's a very finely tuned system, and which is one of the reasons why substance abuse during this time is so devastating. Because what the substances do is they can artificially increase the dopamine. And it's not based on good decisions or success in career or relationships, it's based on the drug itself. And it's during this time when the brain is setting its thermostat, so to speak, of the dopamine levels. And if the drugs are introduced and create these unnaturally high levels of dopamine, this kind of impossible bar to exceed, then even if the teens stop using substances, often in their adult years, they can never feel a sense of fulfillment or recapture that feeling from the early drug use, and they may be successful in career and family and many other domains, but inside they don't feel it. And so we think this is a particularly cruel irony of nature. Right at this time when the brain is so vulnerable, when these changes are so active, is the same time when teens are most likely to experiment with drugs, including alcohol.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on the adolescent brain.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Jay Geed about the adolescent brain. Dr. Geed, what other areas of the brain show dramatic growth at different stages of childhood? We mentioned a little bit about languages.
There's a part of the brain called the basal ganglia, and they're in the centermost part of the brain and involved in many things, but one of them is controlling our fine motor movements involved in sports or playing musical instruments. And between the ages of 7 and 11, there is an enormous explosion in connectivity of the basal ganglia and then a dramatic pruning back, so that up to 50% of these certain cells are lost involved in these activities. And when we talk to coaches or music teachers, they're very quick to confirm that, yes, exposure to the musical instruments or to the sport during that time period seems to be very important to achieve mastery. Not that we can't teach us old dogs new tricks, but to really excel at a musical instrument or a sport, it seems to be very useful to be exposed during this period between ages 7 and 11.
Now, what does that say about earlier exposures? Parents are thinking, okay, then maybe if 7 or 11 is good, this is like one package of toilet paper is on sale at the grocery store. Maybe we should buy 7 because they're on sale.
And it may not be in terms of not that the time would be wasted or that there wouldn't be some benefits from exposure earlier on. Tiger Woods certainly would come to mind for that. But I think that's not inconsistent with there being more optimal times to introduce perhaps things like geometry or foreign languages or other types of skills. The time may be more optimally suited. And even, again, coaches or music teachers can explain that they can give lots of lessons when you're young, but sometimes you have to sort of be at a certain level of maturity before it takes hold and it becomes a really leap in abilities and performance.
Dr. Geed, there's a lot of material out there now in the market that young parents can buy, particularly when they're just beginning a family. And I recently had an interesting conversation with my cousin who has just become a grandmother, and she had been on the phone with her daughter-in-law. And there's a lot of squealing going on in the background. The daughter-in-law said, oh, that's okay. She's just listening to her baby Einstein tapes. And my cousin said, don't worry, you'll learn about that stuff too when your time comes to be a grandmother. And I thought, maybe I need to learn about that and be ready. What is all this stuff?
Yeah, as scientists, we sort of shudder when we hear these things because as much as we would like there to be a good shortcut to optimizing the brain development through audio tapes or videotapes or software on the computer, or we just don't know yet what sort of things actually help guide the brain optimally. But we suspect that it won't be anything too surprising in terms of throughout history there are so many different ways and cultures to raise healthy and happy children. And the common denominators seem to be a loving their caretaker, and that it's kind of scary as parents, I think, to sometimes, did we miss the boat? Did we not get the right tape? Did we not do the right diet? But that, despite it all, how vulnerable the brain can be, it can also be incredibly resilient. And not that I wouldn't say that these things have been all proven to be not helpful, but that as far as we know, it comes down to some pretty basic steps that parents have been doing for a lot of years.
Long before all these contemporary toys that we see all over the place, I was told to glue black and white things inside the bassinet for each child, and then after a period of time, to cover them over with very colorful decorations and designs.
There was a recent article in Science magazine, a very prestigious magazine, that I think caused a lot of parents some concern, and that was looking at the effects of video games on the brain, and I think most people would have suspected that it would have negative type of effects, and in fact, it showed that there were some positive effects from the video games. Not to say that I think that particularly promote those, but just pointing out how little we really know about the specifics of those sort of things. But the reality is that computers are going to be part of our children's and teens' lives in a way much greater than for us parents. And I think that the challenge will be not to not use the computers, but to use them well.
Knowing that certain functions will be especially affected by teens' brain development, should parents try to help their kids exercise those functions in kind of practical ways, like helping plan a family vacation or overseeing a yard work project or planning a budget for the school year? Something we can actually get our money's worth out of.
Yeah, I think that part of the brain science dilemma has been at how variable the children can be. One minute they can be your sweet, charming little baby, and the next minute they can be like an adult, and they can be anywhere in between and can zoom back and forth between adult and child in the matter of moments. And I think that can be one of the very frustrating aspects of parenting, the rapid changes in these sorts of things. And that responsibilities and structure and involving the teens in there can often be a very effective way to teach responsibility and both aspects of having independence and having the responsibility of the independence need to be dealt with. But time and again, teens seem to rise to and exceed the expectations not only of parents but of themselves. In surveys in which teens describe themselves and parents describe them, they usually describe themselves as lazy or irresponsible or not moral. And then when we actually look at what teens are doing in terms of community service and what they're doing with their time, it's not the case at all that teens are doing much better than they're given credit for. It's just, it doesn't make the headlines when they mm-hmm. are doing good things. And so even though it's true that teens can be challenging for parents at times, I think it's really important for parents to remember how fast it will all pass and to really cherish those times when you can laugh together with your children and learn together, because it zooms by.
And those connections that you were talking about being built in the brain are connections that have to do with behavior as well as cognitive.
Exactly so. And in terms of the hard wiring of the brain from our evolution, it's probably not algebra or long division that a great deal of the brain seems to be dedicated to social interactions. And the brain is very set up to learn by modeling, in terms of that's how it can learn how to survive in its environment. And the best modelers, of course, are the parents and sometimes siblings. But teens are exquisitely sensitive to parents who say one thing and do another. And in terms of trying to teach behavior, in terms of leaning on them to play an instrument or do that, it's probably much more effective to model good behavior, in terms of they'll pick that up whether you're sort of preaching to them or not. And I think parents often lose sight of that they're teaching a lot more than they realize they're teaching by their behavior, not just their words.
What further resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to learn more about how the brain develops in children and in adolescents?
I think it can be difficult for parents to find this sort of information, not because there's a lack of information, there's almost too much, and it can be very difficult, I think, to sort out what's what's real and what's not real and what's true and what's a half-truth. And so I think that this is an area that's going to receive a lot more of interest in the science community and in the educational community. It's been so recent that we've actually been able to look inside the living, growing human brain. And I think we're just at the very early stages. But unfortunately for parents, it's hard to know where to turn to for good information. I think the best resource that I've come across is a book called The Primal Teen, P-R-I-M-A-L, a teen written by Barbara Strauch, a New York Times science editor and mother of teens herself, who took some time away from work to meet with scientists across the country. And really pulled together in a very readable but accurate way the story of the teen brain.
Dr. Jay Geed, you have given us a lot of good information in this half hour, and we're very grateful. We really appreciate your coming in and demystifying some of the goings-on that's happening in the teenage brain.
Thank you very much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 189. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.